Today on Speaking Out of Place, we are joined by Sherita Mohlavi, who talks about the ways in which Israel has waged a protracted war on the people and environment of Gaza. Linking this war to its colonial precedents, Mohlavi explains how she, as a researcher for the Forensic Architecture Project, combines technologies like satellite imaging with on-the-ground stories from Palestinian farmers to produce a powerful form of witnessing to Israel's war. She connects the trauma felt by the environment and the trauma felt by the people. She also tells of the new and powerful forms of resistance and resilience that take place at the nexus of nature, landscape, and the Palestinian people. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Welcome. I thought I'd start by saying that I teach your book, and the students love it. They remark upon this passage, and so I'm going to read this passage to you and ask you to elaborate on it in a way that gets to the key arguments of your book about land, landscape, and environmental warfare in Gaza. You write, quote, "The borders of the Jewish state are not at the periphery or margins of the territorial state itself. Israel's borders are not at the border. Rather, its borders, including the inherent logic of exclusion and otherness that its political legal concept produces, are constantly moving with various violent intensities which bleed across categories of citizen, immigrant, resident, and refugee. Palestinian Arab presence within this incorporation regime is situated within a continuous logic of exclusion specific to their civic status, effectively making their bodies into borders. They're included in the Israeli incorporation regime, yet they are perpetually consigned to its peripheries. Together, the racially hierarchical framework of the Israeli state apparatus and its juridical political order determines that the borders of the state, its ideological and conceptual contours, and the limits and ends of its representation and protection all acquire their shape and meaning from the non-Jewish other." So there's a lot there to unpack, but I think that if you speak to it, you can very easily incorporate it into the main argument of your book. So I'll let you start with that, please.
First of all, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be having this conversation with you. The quote that you read is something that I've been working on for most of my adult political and academic life. I've worked in Israel-Palestine for 22 years now. A large part of that work was with Palestinian citizens of Israel, people who are called Arab Israelis, the Arabs within, the forgotten Arabs. And so a large part of my scholarly work actually is on Jewish constitutional thought, is on understanding the nationality regulations and citizenship structures of the state of Israel as an extension of European, Western, liberal, democratic frameworks, and the particular ways in which citizenship is mobilized in Israel, and the particular ways in which citizenship excludes in Israel. Now, I should say that to me, the history of citizenship is one of exclusion. And in this, Israel is not unique at all. It's just that the way that Israel excludes through citizenship is particular to its history and its prioritization of the figure of the immigrant as a full political subject over the figure of the citizen. What I was trying to do there was to provide a framework through which we can understand this piece of land as a single geographic unit, because essentially what we have on this territory is one government, one economy, one currency, one military. We have two sets of laws, one for persons who are Jewish, regardless of whether they have Israeli citizenship or not formally, and one for non-Jewish person. That's part of what gives Israel its apartheid definition, according to numerous experts in human rights organizations who by now have made this argument and pointed to this. This is an old argument from the 80s that Israeli Jews were making by then, and even before that, that Palestinian Arabs had been making for decades before. But this framework is to understand that because we have these two sets of laws, these two sets of laws apply everywhere on this territory. And what it allows us to do is to understand Palestinian Arabs as an other of the state of Israel regardless of whether they are refugees, which is the classical figure of the other to the state, residents of Jerusalem, or citizens, full-on citizens living in Haifa or in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem. They're still an other to the state because of the way that the state's rights and recognition and its own self-identity is organized. And I find this really fascinating because in many ways, Israel is much more honest about its exclusion than Western liberal democracies are. In fact, states like Canada, the US, Germany, the UK, even France are experimenting with ways to denationalize citizens, to dilute citizenship, to disaggregate it, to use a term by Sayla Ben Habib, right? To find ways to render citizens stateless without officially making them stateless, making them into homo sacers, so to speak, through citizenship. Israel is already doing that. When you, as a Palestinian, when you get citizenship in Israel, you are no longer a Palestinian. You become an Arab as a way to de-Palestinianize you, de-indigenize you. But even as an Arab, Arabs are not a recognized national minority group in Israel. So you become essentially a non-Jewish person. And Israel has 173 recognized nationalities, which includes things that don't exist in other parts of the world, like Burmese and unknown and Arab as a national identity, not a recognized national group, but a national identity, all as a way to avoid calling people Palestinian and calling people Israeli, because Israeli is not a national identity in Israel. Jewish is considered a national identity in Israel, but not Israeli. So this phrase was a way for us to understand how the legal and political structures in this country works, or the sovereign state of Israel works, so that we can really understand what's happening in Gaza, in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and in Israel proper, or 48 Palestine, as part of the same continuum, but with different intensities. And here I think it's really important to understand that we have three political structures at play in this country. We have a settler colonial project that uses tools and structures of apartheid, which is the racial discrimination entrenched in law. And that is pushed forward through mechanisms of an occupation. And those three elements, settler colonialism, apartheid, military occupation, they ping pong against each other. And they have different intensities in a city like Haifa than they do in Jerusalem, than they do in Gaza City, than they do in Hebron or Al-Khalil, or than they do in Bethlehem. But they all exist in all of these places, right? You don't see the occupation in Haifa, but if you look for it, you can find it. You can understand how it plays out. You don't feel apartheid in Gaza City right now, but if you look for it and if you understand why the land, for example, is healthier where Jewish settlements existed and unhealthier where Palestinians live, that explains to you how the apartheid structures work. So this is a kind of framework for us to understand this as a single geographic unit. And then from there to look at how these structures play out in a more granular sense in different parts of the country.
Yeah, some of the satellite photographs that you have of the healthy and the unhealthy demarcations of the land is such a chilling reflection of what you're saying. And I was thinking with your comparing it to other so-called democracies like the United States, the, if you will, beauty of Israel's case is that from its foundational documents, it made that essential bifurcation between Jew and non-Jew. And you can trace that back, of course, to the Balfour Declaration. So there's this long history that there was never an assumption that there would be a particular mixture that was not weighted toward one side rather than the other. You have a really compelling way of using landscape, which sort of builds off what I just said, not just the most graphic aspects of it, but in a much more complex and thicker description of what landscape is. Could you talk more about that a little bit?
Yeah. So just to speak first about the satellites, this book is a product of a project that I also did with forensic architecture. I've been working with forensic architecture for over 10 years now. I'm the dedicated Palestine researcher there, Israel-Palestine researcher. I have the privilege of access to the country still for however long that lasts now. And we use satellite images. We use a lot of modeling and open source data for our work. I think our work becomes much more powerful when that's led by and interlaced with testimony and experiences on the ground, which no satellite will capture. I think that's what sets us apart. In the projects where we do that, those are, for me, are the strongest projects and interventions that we've made. When we walk away from a project with more friends than we had before, basically. Mm-hmm. So I had an understanding of the landscape from looking at Israel-Palestine from space, basically. But the landscape that I got to know, which I think is the landscape that I'm referring to in the book, is one from, again, my privileged access to Gaza and working with farmers, understanding sort of granularity of the urban versus rural, what that mm-hmm. could mean in a place like the Gaza Strip, that the moments when the border becomes the space of political action versus the space outside the border, and the way that the sovereign mobilizes the border, this non-human space, mobilizes the environmental elements of the border to put violence on people's bodies, and then how people then respond to that by mobilizing the border as a political space. So the landscape that I'm pointing to is not just the literal landscape of the eastern periphery of the Gaza Strip, which is what I've been looking at historically and heavily through testimonial references of farmers who remembered what that mm-hmm. land looked like before the border started to eat up their trees. Mm-hmm. But it's also a landscape of knowledge production that I'm discussing, a landscape of a vocabulary that we adopt when we discuss this place that doesn't fit. I won't call it a border because a border is misleading. Yeah. I call it a perimeter and an eastern perimeter. I'm quite vague about it. And in a podcast, it's difficult to show all the air quotes that you want to put around buffer zone and sovereign power, etc. So I'm speaking to both, not just the literal physical landscape, but also a landscape of knowledge production, of evidence production. And working with farmers, I've learned how to mobilize not just the testimony of people, but also the testimony of non-human beings, how mm-hmm. to listen and look at the land and learn about forgotten violences by understanding where the land is feeling stress, where the crops are communicating, we can't grow here because the water is too salty, mm-hmm. or we can't grow here because what used to be here was a tree and now it's parsley and the roots of the tree are still there and they're eating us. And you listen to the land, and you learn the testimonies of the land as a way to also remind the people of forgotten traumas that they're reminded of when you tell them. The land felt stressed in these years. And they say, oh, yeah, actually, in those years, we actually have a number of military operations that I forgot about or that I had heard about. That's why the land felt stressed. So this is the kind of landscape that I'm more interested in engaging with. It's less tangible, but it's mm-hmm. just as kinetic as anything else.
Absolutely. And actually, this is exactly the direction I wanted us to take. But I thought I'd interrupt us at this point just for a half a second to back up. Could you tell more about the ambitions behind forensic architecture? In other words, the larger project. Why did it come into being? And what is it?
Forensic architecture is a research group based at Goldsmiths University in London. We've been around for, I think, 10, 11 years now. It's led and founded by Eyal Weitzman. He's an Israeli architect who spent most of his life looking at the ways in which a lived space and architecture is mobilized by Israel as part of its expansion and domination of Palestinians. He did some of the first major projects on the settlements in the West Bank, which were historic and really set the stage for how to understand what's happening in the country, also as an architectural mm-hmm. war, as an architectural battle. And so in that sense, forensic architecture is an organization, but it's also a way of doing research. It's a method. And it's a way of doing research that looks at visual and spatial evidences, resources, mostly open source evidences and resources. And we investigate state and corporate violence, instances of it all over the world. Of course, our work started from Israel-Palestine, but yeah. We work everywhere where we can. And what we learn from the Palestinian context, we are applying to other parts of the world. How do you do research on a place that you can't access? What's available to you? And when you have direct access, how deep can you go? In the case of Gaza, I looked at the leaves that were yeah. burnt, and I read the siege on Gaza through the leaves as witnesses, bio indicators or, mm-hmm. or bio witnesses. And that's really what forensic architecture is. It's a room of people coming from different disciplines, the lawyer talking to the theorist, to the developer, to the modeler, to the architect, to the artist, We work with environmental scientists when we can. We work with cybersecurity and munitions mm-hmm. experts where we can, depending on the project. We work very closely with the communities that mm-hmm. are directly affected, and often the families of people who've been targeted or injured or killed or gone missing. And you all try to answer the same question, right? You have an investigative question that everybody answers from their discipline. So it's interdisciplinary in a proper way. Not only do people from different disciplines speak, but you put yourself in someone else's discipline and you walk away knowing more about how an environmental scientist would approach this question than you would coming from your own sort of place of learning. So that's it. I would say FA is an organization, but it's also a way of thinking. It's a way of doing political and research and academic work. And for this reason, because we have people from various disciplines, we also present our work in different fora. Our work is used in courtrooms, domestic, international, but it's also presented in galleries in different ways. And it's taught in universities, mobilized in citizen tribunals and on the street. It's presented in the press. So you mobilize all of the fora that you can. And in that sense, we also get a lot of pushback. This is always something that our director says, but the artists tell us you're not artists. And the human rights activists tell us you're not really human rights workers. And the architects are saying none of you are architects properly. So we're on the periphery. And I think that's a great place to be.
Absolutely. It's actually strategically very powerful because you are responsible to yourselves only. And so I want to go back to exactly where we were talking about before. And one of the examples that you give really struck me as incredibly powerful. I think the essential ambition is accountability, how to bring those who are performing violence to accountability when they are engaging in all these evasive measures. And you talk about how Israel will map out wind currents. So it will drop pesticides in a certain area in the border, knowing full well that in an hour, it will spread exponentially across into lands where it has no even vague alibi for being there, thereby erasing its accountability. But as you were saying, nature landscape also testifies to this perversion and instrumentalization. And you talk about land as bearing witness, which I thought was one of the most powerful formulations. And as you said before, how land remembers trauma. And of course, then, as you were saying before, this correlation between land remembering trauma, being able then through this evidence to remember their own trauma, this sort of mutually reinforcing body of testimonials, as you said. How does your work show how the landscape validates precisely the Palestinian cultural memory that Israel is so intent to destroying? How nature becomes an ally for this project, offering a kind of, again, testimony?
Yeah, I think it's important to place what Israel is doing within a longer colonial record of colonizers use the environment to dominate, to control, to surveil colonized populations. And in this, Israel is not unique. Using herbicides as a way to produce borders, it was done in Texas, it's done in Ecuador, Colombia. It's not unique in this. Again, each of these cases are part of a historical continuum. States learn from each other how to mobilize environments, how to militarize them against people. The people also learn how to resist in creative ways, and they do it in different ways. The case of the herbicidal warfare was really interesting because there was a moment when, in my work, I start with the testimony, I end with testimonies. Farmers were telling me they are spraying this on our land inside Gaza boundaries, on Gazan land. And that's where we started. And we were desperately trying to show this until we realized, no, that's not what's happening. Israel is not, we don't have any evidence of them spraying inside of the occupied Gaza Strip. They're literally spraying on the border. But by their own admission, because we did a Freedom of Information request at Gisha, an Israeli NGO based in Tel Aviv, asking about this practice. And by their own admission, they only spray when the wind is going into Gaza. In the morning, the wind goes from the east to the west into the Gaza Strip towards the sea. By the afternoon, the wind turns and it goes west to east in this part of the world. And they only spray in the morning hours when the wind goes east to west into Gaza. They don't spray in Gaza, but only knowing when the wind takes it. And they test this in a very sort of primitive way also by setting a wheel on fire. You have wind direction devices you can use, but they set the wheel on fire as a kind of smoke signal that it's coming for farmers, but because farmers don't get any warning that this is coming. And they start from the north of the strip and they spray down And admitting this was already significant, that they find ways to coordinate the presence of soldiers on the ground who then set the tire to tell you where the wind is going. We also saw this in the footage that farmers collected. I did a campaign where I handed out phones to farmers along the border so they could film. And those farmers were also for the first time put on a WhatsApp group where when the farmer in the north saw that they were spraying, we put it in the group so the farmers in the south could start covering their crops, things that had never been done before. They would start spraying already at 5, 6 a.m. So where farmers are awake at that time, if you're a farmer. Yeah. Creating these kinds of networks was part of the way that we responded to this practice. But the mobilizing the wind in this way gave them a kind of carte blanche, saying, we're not spraying in Gaza, we have no responsibility. Our task was to show that, okay, it's the wind taking it in, but the damage to what you're doing is only on the Gazan side, or overwhelmingly on the Gazan side. And that is the argument that Gisha used in Israeli courts to try to get this practice banned. In one occasion, the wind turned and the poisons landed on the farms of a nearby kibbutz, Nahal Oz. Mm. And that kibbutz, those farmers took the Ministry of Defense to court. They pushed back. After a lot of difficulties also, they were able to get compensated for something in the amount of 18,000-19,000 Israeli shekels. And they still reported that the season after, their land still hadn't recovered from the herbicide sprayed before. So you can just imagine the kind of long-term damage that this does on the Gazan side. But what's interesting is that when I'm talking to the farmers, I of course want to understand how the spraying in the present time is affecting their land. Most of these farmers in the eastern periphery, they are growing crops that are low crops. They're no longer than 80 centimeters to a meter because of the Israeli regulation that crops over 1 meter will be flattened to ensure optimal security visibility. So these farmers, they're used to growing trees and they've had to forcefully transition to lower growing crops, herbs, watermelons, eggplants, broccoli, sometimes things that aren't eaten locally. And they had to learn how to do this, because it's about creating different knowledge production also. You're taught from your parents and your grandparents how to take care of a tree, but a strawberry needs some totally different treatment. Yeah. I was asking them about their real-time confrontation with the environmental violence of the Israeli army, but also about the longer histories of this. And there, that was when the testimony of the land came in. Because I would tell them, I see in this period your land experienced stress, what happened? And often farmers couldn't remember what happened until I gave them more details around, okay, it was around these months. Did you suddenly lose a crop? Did you yourself spray something that killed a batch of your crops? Did you set it on fire just to invigorate the soil? And that would help them remember things. So when I went by what the land felt as stress, the moments when the land was less productive or too productive or suddenly went from green to red and then red to green, means that something very violent was happening. When I went by that, by the emotion of the land, the emotions of the landscape, farmers were able to remember moments of loss, basically, that they hadn't remembered. And this was important. This was important because the moments when I didn't capture things on the land, the farmers filled that in. And the moments when I didn't capture things with testimonies of farmers, the land filled it in. And it was a kind of conversation. And that's really, if you look at indigenous scholarship, that's more the methodologies there look at non-human beings as political subjects, trees as political subjects. And that's very much what happened in this project, that it's not accidental that your Palestinian leader is giving an ode to the tree and an ode to the olive, because they're part of what is being violated. This kind of sensibility isn't always what counter-forensic techniques can capture. Right. Yeah, the satellite image is a military gaze. It doesn't capture the sensibility of what the farmer feels and what the farmer goes through and what the land feels. Right. And I think the moment you infuse that sensibility, senses essentially, into a satellite image, there's something magical that happens in terms of the research.
That's such a rich and complex statement. I wanted to say just three things. One is, I apologize to our listeners for the fact that there's no visual, because Dr. Molavi has some amazing videos of precisely the tracing of these herbicides into Gaza And so we will put on our blog several links to all the visuals, not just still photos, but also film, which really show this explosion of toxic materials into Gaza. That's one thing. The second thing is I couldn't help but thinking during the Israeli case with the kibbutz, they can't say, no, it's not our fault. We really meant it to go to Gaza. You were collateral damage. They couldn't admit that. But you mentioned broccoli, and I was thinking from oranges to broccoli, the way in which this forced deprivation of not just a crop, but an entire culture, and the way the Palestinians are so incredibly resilient and resistant to these impositions, and yet still there is this tremendous loss. So I wanted to get to the question that I think lies at the heart of these kinds of statements, which is the connection between genocide and ecocide, the way in which land and people are not separate, but they're integrated together. And when the Israeli government attacks both human beings, non-human animals, and the natural world, it's a purposeful and targeted way of destroying the replication of a life world. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing playing out in Gaza is exactly that part of targeting a population is targeting their environment. That's something that imperial and colonial powers understood very early on. The British were the first to use, you know, herbicidal warfare to push back against the Malay uprising. You had Americans in Afghanistan destroying entire swaths of trees and then planting them in straight lines so that they could have visibility. Colonial imperial states understood this very early on. So what we're seeing happening now in Gaza is a continuation of that. And that's we can't read it in isolation from Western legacies, their eco-colonial imaginaries, which they were very honest about in their literature, in their fiction, in their imagery, in their poster. None of this is a secret. But we see that very clearly now. The videos that you referred to is projects that we did at Forensic Architecture. And we did an update to those same farms that I looked at in 2018. We went back to them, and now we see bypass roads being built across them. We see a buffer zone being expanded, a so-called buffer zone being expanded over three times its size onto those agricultural lands. We see that the Israeli army has systematically destroyed agricultural farms and infrastructure, including greenhouses. Where the ground invasion goes, farms and greenhouses become destroyed, flattened, and then fortifications are built on those lands for the military. So absolutely, part of control and surveillance, monitoring, domination is controlling the environment that people live in. And in that sense, it's completely consistent historically with the way these things have played out. At the same time, what is also consistent is that people never just swallow state repression. People always find a way to work differently. And so if you look at refugee camps, the new camps on top of existing old camps that existed in Gaza, you will see that people in the small plot that they have, what they're growing so that they can immediately start planting herbs and vegetables, immediately start cultivating, immediately build networks of exchange that are beyond material currency. This is a huge part of the resistance. It's part of an insistence also to live and to declare their connection with the land. And I think that's fascinating because in the Palestinian struggle, the land, Al-Ard, is so central. And yet younger generation Palestinians had very little connection to the land. They spend their time in the city. Most don't go to farms, don't work in farms. The image of the olive tree is there, but it's always annoying for a teen to go and participate in the olive harvest here and there. At least what's happening, what had happened in Gaza, particularly in 2018 in the Great March, was that people went to areas where farmlands were. And what's happening now also in the camps, and particularly in the middle and southern areas of Gaza, is that young people are forced to have to live off of the land because of the complete destruction and decimation of the social fabric and of the social institutions in the Gaza Strip that we've seen over the past year. At the same time, and I hope that came across also in the book, that the book outlines state violence. It outlines a systematic destruction of the environment as a way also to destroy a population and their connection and their memory and their knowledge of that space. But it also outlines how people push back and how in a small piece of land that they have, they make sure to an homage to what was there before. And how even though, okay, they're forced to grow broccoli, which is not at all indigenous to Palestine and used, how they still insist to have olive trees here and there just to make the landscape something recognizable to them. And then the funny story from one farmer who's still with us, thankfully, Mona, who I work with very closely. She's now displaced in the southern areas of Gaza. She would tell me, we grew the broccoli because it was doable. And then we had to teach people how to cook it because they would give it to their animals to eat because they're used cauliflower, but not broccoli. So it also affects how people then eat. Mm. New recipes are coming out and new stories will come out, myths and knowledges. Mm. And what that does, as much as it shows a resilience, it also cuts Gaza from the rest of Palestine because you have a new way of making a traditional dish that is becomes a Gazan way and is a response to the ecocide that they're faced with, the forced transition and cultivation that they're faced with, that you don't have in the same way in Bethlehem and you don't have in Jericho, for example, in the same way. So it affects all of this, that killing a people is not just physically killing them, right? It's transforming them, making them into different types of people because of their environment. And again, what we're seeing is people never just swallow state violence. And that's extremely important for me to get across as well.
Absolutely. And just to give our listeners a sense of how microscopic this is, I had another guest on, Palestinian guest on, saying she was told she could not pick a certain kind of tea leaf. Certain kinds of teas are deemed to be illegal precisely because of this connection they have to this larger structure. But your comments get me to perhaps the last thing I want to ask you about, which was, you have an amazing conclusion to your book, which talks a lot about acts of resistance. You've recently went to Gaza since the publication of this book. So I was going to ask you about how things stand now, especially since the border in the north includes South Lebanon, right? How has your perception of what's going on now in Palestine shifted, as well as any possibilities for resistance? How has the current situation affected your perceptions?
Ways I'm doing what I have done in the past in terms of how I approach my contribution. My contributions are still people-led, community-led. People tell me what is happening, what is understudied, and then I try to look into that. I'm still keeping my connections with the farmers that I've worked with the students that I taught in Palestine, with the journalists that I worked with so intimately to produce the images and the films, with forensic architecture. One in particular that I dedicated the book to, Rushdie Sarraj. Yesterday was the anniversary, 1 year anniversary of his targeted killing. So I'm doing it in that same way. What I'm realizing is that we do need to reorient our efforts. So I think one thing that I'm doing differently is I'm trying to find a way to position myself differently vis-a-vis the fora. Because the courts have, for a large part, failed Palestinians. Universities are becoming closed spaces for having these conversations. The press's coverage has been horrendous and dehumanizing, with no international press present and really no global protest being by journalists being denied access. I'm finding myself working very closely with medical practitioners. They are the one demographic that have had regular access to Gaza, for largely dual national Palestinian doctors, but also many non-Palestinian doctors, Jewish American doctors who are going in and out of Gaza. Their testimonies are really something to work with, that tells you what's happening on the ground and how people are resisting at a local level. And I think that reorientation to the fore is something that nobody has really figured out an answer to yet. We're still going to the familiar actors, asking them for accountability and recognition and pressure. And the heartbreaking thing is that when these institutions fail for Palestinians, they fail for everybody. Yeah. When the Security Council resolution is not respected, considered suddenly non-binding, they fail for everyone. Yeah. The next war, wherever it is in the world, hospitals will be considered fair game. Yeah. Schools will be considered fair game. Journalists will be considered fair game, because we've now seen this televised live for us on our devices, and it's become normalized for us to see, despite still feeling nauseous every time we see it. It's setting a precedent, because Israel is in this world that is part of a continuum of state violence, and states learn from each other. And that's the fear that I have of what is to come. What I've also come away with is that what has not worked. The ecocide has played out, and it's for the large part, it's working. It's, of course, it's creating starvation in a place that has very high food insecurity, where people rely on local production. It's created malnutrition and affected fundamentally, physically, emotionally, mentally, psychologically, future generations of Palestinians whose environments have been completely decimated and destroyed. But what they have not successfully been able to do is to tear apart the Palestinian social fabric.
Yeah.
People are not eating each other. There is such a strong support system that people still have. Of course, theft and instability and family fights are rising in Palestine, in Gaza, as they would anywhere facing a genocide for over a year to such an extent, a barrage of attacks for over a year. But people are still taking care of each other, cooking collectively, living collectively, taking care of each other's children. A humanity, an empathy, a care is there. And I often think about this. I live in Stockholm, and I think, how long before my neighbor would come after me if this if this was happening in Stockholm? I'm reminded of COVID, when people would fight each other on the streets in the West for a roll of toilet paper. Scenes we did not see in this part of the world, in the Middle East. We just didn't see these kinds of things there. A different kind of desperation, of course, but that community fabric, that social fabric, hasn't been ripped apart fully in the way that we would expect, and I think in the way that this military campaign is aiming to do. And that's also something that I came away with and was reassuring. I will say that what is really difficult to fathom is the position of farmers and fishermen and women now. Because if you're a journalist and you're relegated to living in a tent city, you can still find a way to survive. You film, you document, take interviews. If you're a teacher, you teach in the camp. If you're an artist, I work with artists who are making marionettes and art pieces at the camp. But a farmer and a fisherman, one, they're not used to living in close quarters with other people because they're used to open space. Two, they're used to working with the land or working in the sea. They've been essentially cut from doing this. So they really are a fish out of water, so to speak. They're living in close quarters. They're not able to work or live off of the land. How they are surviving is really just mind-boggling to me. And that added layer of trauma and difficulty and distress that they're feeling now for over a year is also understudied and needs attention, because their loss is a different kind of existential loss than somebody who's of another trade, somebody whose relationship to the land isn't as fundamental for their daily life.
Yes, exactly.
So this is the only thing that I came away with. Of course, in addition to the horrific scenes that you would see and the kind of excruciating tearing apart of the basic security systems that we have as human beings, the basic dignity happening en masse to people, regardless of their class, their status. And there are no secrets in Gaza. It's very clear. And people have a very refreshing and sober understanding of notions of human rights and protection, rights, responsibility, the international order. The average person, from the five-year-old child to the 90-something-year-old, is the best sociologist you'll meet. These are the kinds of things you also come away from. I've said this in a lot of places, but Gaza is where the humans are.
Yeah.
In more than one way. And this is part of why, when you're there, you feel you can't breathe because it's so overwhelming. Even for the people there are feeling suffocated. And then when you leave, you can't breathe because you want to go back.
Yeah.
Because you love the people there and you love your friends there. And yeah, there is a sense of responsibility you feel immediately because of the horrific nature of the violations and the global failure that you're witnessing.
Absolutely. Yeah. You spoke so powerfully about how if Israel gets away with this, that sets a precedent, it opens a door for this to proliferate unimpeded. But at the same time, your comments and your work has done so much to counterbalance that and give us some sort of sense that that's not the only world that we have to live in. I can't thank you enough for taking time to be with us. I remind our listeners that we will have a blog up so you can actually see these photographs and see these films and hopefully contribute to forensic architecture for all the invaluable work it's doing. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, for making space for this. I really appreciate your work and your commitment to creating a space to have these conversations in a moment when the other fora are failing us. So thank you.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.